This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Hannah Gadsby's Nanette is being described as a biting social satire, painted with the glossy finish of a Netflix comedy special, and also the first truly post-Me Too comedy special. Joining me now to dissect this powerful show are Shamila Gunnison and Lee Chui Lin, both producers and presenters with BFM. And we're going to look at why so many people are talking about this 40-year-old Tasmanian comics show, which probes the dark side of self-deprecation. Deprecating humor while making the audience confront some very harsh truths. Welcome, ladies. How are you today?
We're good. Thank you very much.
Yes, indeed.
Welcome back, Lynn, to BFM.
Thank you. Such a warm welcome from Juliet Jacobs, as always.
My former teammate on Bigger Picture now with the Evening Edition. No bitterness there. So let's get straight to...
on a feminist welcome. Show.
I'm celebrating my female colleague's return to another team. Anyway, so for some context, it was late June and Tasmanian-born Hannah Gadsby's stand-up special, which is called Nanette, it made its debut on Netflix. And it's got people all over the world talking. Sharmila, you brought this show to our attention. Tell me, how did you first hear about it?
Well, I actually first heard about it because people were posting about it on Facebook. And what struck me was everyone was just saying, you have to watch this. You have to watch this. Yeah. Without talking too much about why you have to watch this. And then my sister texted me from Australia, where she was staying at that time. And she went, Sharmila, you have to watch this. And I kind of just went into it quite blind in that sense. You know, I went in not knowing what the show was about, really, except that it was by this queer woman from Tasmania, and that it supposedly upended what comedy was. And I was just blown away. I laughed, I cried, I got angry. And yet it was more than just entertainment. Mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. So that's why I thought it was worth sharing the gospel of Nanette, I suppose.
And Lynn, I mean, we made you watch it as part of your assignment to, you know, be allowed into this, you know,
to ingratiate myself. Yeah. No, I mean, it's my experience is much the same as Shamila in the sense that I think there were a lot of think pieces that came out about it. And it's understandable because, of course, with the glut of stuff that's on Netflix, what you end up watching is what, in some ways, what people tell you to watch or what ends up exploding in the public eye.
And so there was
a whole glut of think pieces all about Nanette. And I identified it as something that I wanted to watch. And because of that, I identified it as something that I didn't necessarily want to read about. I didn't want that experience of going into it completely fresh because all the headlines seem to be suggesting that this was something different. And the thing about the comedy special is that Netflix does a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And there is a format, right? Like, you know, there is an introduction and then you see somebody up on stage, they speak for an hour, they flow as a storyteller for an hour, and then it's over and that's it. And you get a sense of who they are. But in this sense, it was comedy and I don't know. I think it was just... The element of storytelling seemed so much more important. It felt like comedy was the gateway drug. It was just the thing that, you know, okay, here, you'll laugh a little bit, we'll all be happy. And that's what makes it so special, right? Because it slides into that depth and then suddenly you're in the middle of it and you're thinking, I'm transfixed, I'm uncomfortable, I'm unhappy, I'm angry. This is really funny also, but oh my God.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when she starts off, she uses her identity, you know, as she identifies as a lesbian and she draws from her experiences as a lesbian as fodder for her jokes. But then she's self-deprecating. And I think she kind of uses that as, you know, humor as a path to sincerity kind of trick to make us her friend. And, you know, for me, it was lulling me into a false sense of normalcy, I suppose. You know, you kind of figure, oh, yeah, I know what I'm going to expect from this. Right. But then...
So, you know that thing she says about how comedy is two parts, right? Mm-hmm. It's a question and then it's, what is it?
It's a setup and a punchline.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. It's a setup and a punchline. It's tension and then release.
Yeah.
And I think at the start, she really sets it up in a way where she starts to problematize that very premise. And she does that pretty early on. I think about 15 minutes in, she starts to tell you, look, this isn't necessarily going to be what you thought it was.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beginning of the inkling of, okay, this is not going to be what I expect. I find it hard to talk about. Do you find it hard to talk about?
I do. And it's primarily because I feel like so much of it is, I found it interesting and absolutely apt that you called it storytelling. And that's because that's what she does, you know, and that's her whole premise, that being a comedian, you have that two-part premise, the setup and the punchline.
Yeah.
Whereas stories are three-part, the beginning, a middle, and an end. And she says that. And that's actually precisely why it's difficult for us to talk about it, I think, because we're used to talking about comedy acts in that two-part structure. Whereas with stories, like if you think about when you talk about a book or a movie, you don't want to give away the ending. You don't want to spoil the story. And in a way, Hannah Gatsby's Nanette is a story. And that's why I feel like, so what does she make jokes about? But I don't think she actually is making jokes about, like, there isn't a punchline in that sense. So I find it quite difficult. I now understand why everyone was saying, watch it, without quite being able to articulate or maybe not wanting to tell you why you should watch it, you know?
Also because I think she talks about the responsibility of not freezing a story as a joke.
Yes.
As a joke. Yeah. Because
yes.
When you, and I understand that, because as a stand-up comedian or as a performer of any kind, I think you end up kind of internalizing your act, right? It becomes something like muscle memory, you know, every beat, every turn of the head, everything you do, it becomes built in. And that's how I think jokes, in this case, end up crystallizing and hardening and becoming the story, as opposed to the more nuanced version of what actually happened, which is something that she completely deconstructs, right? She starts off with these one-two punch jokes about a guy who, basically mistook her as a man and then realized, oh, you're a woman, I can't beat you up. And then of not being able to come out to her grandma. And those are set up at the start as like, haha, look at me.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny being a queer lady negotiating the world? And later on, what she reveals about the shame and the true stories behind those jokes, I think those are the moments where you realize, and I think that's why it's so meta, and that's why people are saying it's changing comedy, because in a way it forces you to look at every other joke that people tell, mm-hmm. And look at it and think, well, what's the story?
Yeah. Mm.
And I think that what you were saying also about this idea of why it's difficult to talk about it is because talking about it feels almost like you're minimizing that story.
Yes.
For me to tell you one or two sentences of what she said, yes, it was powerful to me in that moment, but it's only a part of the story that she's telling. And it feels like you're doing what you're almost not meant to do with that material.
Because it's like, you know how we spoke about the punchline and all of that, and then, but it doesn't actually, it fails to actually grapple with the reality of what formed that joke, right? That's essentially what she was going for. And how then, you know how halfway through she decided she wants to quit comedy.
Yeah, and that's something she says a few times. I think I need to quit comedy.
Yeah.
I think I need to stop doing this. And I found that very interesting because some of the criticism that's been leveled against her, and maybe, you know, it's an interesting discussion. Is this even comedy at all?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it comedy if by halfway through your show, people aren't really laughing so much? But then I quite liked her response on Twitter to one of these posts where she said, well, when a genre isn't constructed with you in mind, in this case, stand-up comedy as a genre that was first built to accommodate men, then you need to deconstruct or tear down that genre to make it what you want it to be. And I thought, isn't that what all great art does? And isn't that what all great artists do, to remake an existing art form or genre, to use it to tell their story, so to tell a different story?
Well, to take it off on a small tangent, it's similar to, I suppose an analogy would be whether or not an exploitation film can ever be made without the male gaze.
Mm-hmm.
So if I, as a female director, am a fan of the exploitation style of movie, does that then mean that I'm unable to make a perfectly serviceable, great B-movie filled with gore and violence and, you know, nudity? If I'm a woman, does that exclude me? You know, and I think that's an interesting question to ask, whether a genre you love that has traditionally excluded you means that, does that mean it cannot accommodate you if you want to start to try and change it or participate in it? Because I think, fine, okay, comedy is, it should make people laugh. But you also hear all these maxims about it, right? It should be about punching up. It should be about speaking truth to power. Mm-hmm. It should be about offering a difference in perspective, right? That's half of what observational comedy is. It's just somebody standing there going, hey, did you ever notice? Blah. You know, and so now you have somebody doing that. And fine, maybe you didn't find it funny. Maybe the women in the audience, I think, enjoyed it more than the men. So if someone is saying it's not comedy, are they just saying then it's not comedy for men?
Right. And humor or comedy generally is about discomfort anyway.
Exactly.
So all she's doing, or what she's doing, is sort of pushing that into a more uncomfortable, and perhaps why they can't quite see it as comedy is because it's too uncomfortable for them. But it's only a continuum of what a lot of comics have already been doing. Tig Notaro did stand up on her cancer diagnosis.
Cancer, yeah.
Hasan Minhaj's Homecoming King, yes, it was jokes about race and being a South Asian in the US, but it was also about deeply uncomfortable family moments, deeply personal stories about his father and him. It was funny, but it was also uncomfortable. So I actually see this as a great evolution of what comedy can be. And of course, the common thread between the three examples is that they are all from positions of minority in some way.
Marginalized
in some way. So, of course, they are the ones who are going to reimagine what the art form can be for them. Because originally, there wasn't a space for them.
I also think that when it comes to this question of whether or not it's comedy, that usually comes from a space of, why do you guys have to come into my house and start rearranging my furniture?
Right. Yeah,
you know,
yep.
as opposed to thinking, well, okay, we had this house, and now we're adding to it and we're building to it, and now it's going to be a commune. And, you know, there are going to be a lot of different perspectives, and we can all decide where the sofa goes, you know, or where different sofas go. There is this notion that there is only one monolith of what is funny and what is comedy. And, like, I don't think everybody needs to do a Nanette, and I'm not interested in that world, quite frankly. I don't need to emerge from every Netflix comedy special feeling the way I felt after I watched Nanette. Mm-hmm. It's different. Different functions.
Right, of course.
And so I don't think anybody is sitting here saying, you know what, this is going to change everything. There are still going to be people who are doing sets today, tonight, right now, who are not going to be talking about their trauma.
Sure, and it should be that way. No?
Exactly. So this question of whether or not it is comedy. It just may not be comedy as you know it, and that's fine.
All right, we need to stop for a quick break. I'm speaking today to Sharmila Gunnison and Lee Chui Lin, both producers and presenters with BFM 89.9. And we're discussing the Australian comic Hannah Gadsby's show Nanette, which is just making waves across the world. And we'll continue our discussion after this quick break. You are listening to Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today, the two very lovely ladies, Lee Chui Lin and Sharmila Gunnison, both producers and presenters here at BFM 89.9. And we're discussing the comic show Nanette, which was presented by Hannah Gadsby and which is apparently changing the face of stand-up comedy. And, you know, people are having a lot of good reviews, a lot of, you know, good reaction, but also some bad ones. The trolls are always there. But I think for me, you know, something that really struck me was how she had used comedy, you know, to talk about her trauma as well. But the humor actually failed to protect her from real life threats, from, you know, from being beaten up, you know, and no one coming to her aid. And I mean, how did you guys feel about that?
It, you know, the moment she revealed the truth behind the particular incident, I don't want to give too much away, but essentially a joke that she had been using very often around her queer identity, which then resulted in her getting physically assaulted. And that part was the part she never told.
Yeah.
That for me was one of the most powerful. That was the point at which it clicked. And, you know, I started crying because it was such a shock. And it was also that part when I realized how important stories can be and how important stories are for people who are in marginalized positions, and how when we deny them that story, we take away such a big part of not just protection, but healing and being able to move on. And we also do that to ourselves.
Yes.
And that's what she had been doing. And I think she sort of says that in another point as well. I may be not having the exact quote, but where she says, when you make self-deprecating jokes, but from a position of being a minority or a marginalized person, it's not humility, but it's humiliation. And that was, for me, quite profound, because I think that's something that, and I do not claim at all to have been nearly through as much as she has, but that's something I think I've done a lot through my life. And it made me think about, why did I do that? Why do I do that? Sometimes it's a way of thinking that this will shield you from the worst things that the world will do to you. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And I think that was, for me, one of the most significant things that came out of Nanette.
I think a lot of people end up doing that, especially when they are uncomfortable in every room because they're just uncomfortable with themselves. Mm-hmm. And truth be told, that's most teenage girls. I mean, that's most teenagers, but I can only speak from my perspective of having been a teenage girl. And, you know, you identify the things that make you different, and then you kind of start to build your own little stand-up routine around that, right? Because you just want to get there before everyone else
does.
Yeah,
you want to say it before someone else says it, because it doesn't hurt as much when you say it to yourself.
I mean, yes. It still hurts that people agree, but still. Problem.
You know, you put yourself down kind of just to get permission to be heard, to speak.
Exactly. And I think that was, for me, I thought that was incredibly profound when she said that. There were several beats, I think, in an hour, right, which was the length of the show, where you felt your heart drop, or at least I did, where you really feel like, what am I watching? And one of them, for me, that kind of slowly built up my understanding of what she was doing was her point about tension. And she says that basically, you know, sharing a laugh is a collective release of tension. And when she was growing up, she was the tension that people needed releasing from. And that's that point about self-deprecation. Mm-hmm. When you sense, I think, difference in yourself and you enter a space that you feel might not be safe, then the permission is, I know I'm causing tension, but everyone laugh at me.
Yeah, I'll diffuse it for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why she says she's quitting comedy, right? To go back to that point we were making earlier, she says she's quitting comedy because she's done relieving the tension. And she's done relieving the tension because she has been uncomfortable all her life. And now you can be, just for an hour, as uncomfortable as she has been. And that is something that I found really, I think, in when you look at the reactions to Me Too, since it is the first big post-Me Too comedy special. And if you look at the reactions to a lot of the Me Too coverage, I think there has been that element of men and women. I don't want to just put it on men, but men and women being unable to sit with discomfort. Mm-hmm. It's like, absolutely. Oh, I don't like talking about sex, and now you've talked about it. I know you're the victim, but what were you wearing? You know, and so there's that element
of it, right?
Not funny,
not funny.
But there is definitely that element of, look, I'm feeling this tension, and I'm just going to, I don't know. I just want to sit with it, so I'm going to put you down, and then you'll shut up, right? Because I put you down, so this is the end of the conversation.
And I'll feel the world is right again.
Exactly. And I think that's what we're seeing with Nanette, is what she ends up saying, again, not to give too much away, but what she ends up saying is, that's not good enough anymore as a conversation. And so, and I think what she's saying is, I don't want to speak for her, but I think what she's saying is, as a comedian, that's not good enough anymore to tell jokes and not stories. Because stories are ways to share. Jokes are just little perfectly formed things that are not engageable with. You can't engage with a joke, you know. It is an answer. It is a perfect circular thing. Whereas a story is open-ended.
Actually, that's a great way of talking about what I noticed when I sort of sat and thought about Nanette for a while, which is that it's easy to get swept away with the content and the emotion of it. But it is also an excellent piece of writing.
Very.
And you don't think about it when you're watching it, but when I sat down, I thought about it. And everything that she says you should do, the three-part structure, the beginning, the middle, and the end, she does it in her show. Everything she alludes to in the start ends up becoming a part of the story, so the middle, and then it ends up being concluded at the end, not in a way that relieves your tension or makes you comfortable, but in a way that stories are meant to be, to get you to ask questions and to get to think and to get you to see inside someone else's life, maybe. And that, for me, is what I think is quite amazing from a from an artistic perspective as well as what the content is about. The fact that you can do this, you can talk about things that are important and big and painful, and you can still be really good at what you do. And for me, that is perhaps why I think Nanette is worth talking about.
Also, it was flawlessly performed.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah, as a piece of performance, you know, as somebody who also identifies as tired, which she does at the start of the show, you know, I think it takes so much self-control every day to not just kind of run into the street screaming, you know, about how the world is burning. And you know, when you feel that way, and again, I'm not saying I've been through a tenth of what she's been through. So if I feel this way, how does she feel? And for her to deliver it with such control, you know, it takes a lot to not break down. I mean, I cried, you cried.
I did, yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah, but you might have, you know, but there's that feeling,
that
right?
Yeah.
And that build up, and to be able to deliver it the way she did without crying, so important, because she's claiming her power at the end. I don't know. It was flawless, I thought.
So did I. And I did identify. I could see the wonder of her writing and her performance all as I was watching. I was just marveled at how she's taking all these painful things, but, you know, presenting it so beautifully as well. Mm-hmm. Such a moving way. It made you guys cry. I mean, it made me cringe. It made me really sad. But just, wow, what an amazing person. And another thing that I like, you know, just going back to the post-Me Too, you know, how it's a post-Me Too comedy special, you know, I was very struck by the connection she drew between art, abuse, you know, and the way we talk about great artists, for example, like she calls it Van Gogh.
We shall.
Van Gogh, yeah. and Pablo Picasso. How did you guys feel about that? You know, I mean, she basically stated how she hates Picasso because he's essentially a sexual predator.
And a misogynist.
And a misogynist.
A lifelong misogynist.
Lifelong misogynist, yeah.
I suppose one could make the argument that, you know, there was no legal age of consent in France at the time when he married his 17-year-old
in her prime
lover. Who
did he marry her? He was married,
sorry,
and he had an
right,
affair.
Right, no, and
with
right.
Him.
So, long-time partner then. But I found...
Slept with a 17-year-old, let's just put it that
let's
way.
Just, yes, let's just, you know, say it as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that the connections she made were brilliant, and because it talks about that male gaze, it talks about, you know, years of building this idea of men shaping the way we view women, the way we view ourselves, and, you know, Picasso being held up as a great artist. I still like his art, you know, but having watched Nanette, I have to say there was a part of me that felt slightly ashamed that I had been able to separate who he was and I knew who he was in his personal life. And the fact that I could still appreciate his art. And yeah, of course you could still appreciate his art, but perhaps I shouldn't have been compartmentalizing who he was with the work he does.
That was that point she was making about reputation and humanity, right? She was saying that we've become a society that prizes reputation and the reputation of men,
mm-hmm.
Even though they might be men who have long separated from their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same point she was making with Van Gogh, which was that he, you know, he's very famous now. Sunflowers, great. But at what cost when he was alive, and also this whole building up of him as the suffering artist, and
right,
therefore
yes,
the notion
right.
that artists must suffer.
Yeah.
Because, of course, we've been talking about it from a feminist point of view. We are feminists, this is Feminist Friday, but she also makes a lot of points about identity mm-hmm. and about connection and about just trauma, just about human pain. And one of the things she talked about was this notion that creatives must suffer.
Right. And Van Gogh was really the primary example that she uses. Then she links it to herself, that idea of using her trauma and her humor.
Well, a man linked it.
That's true. Yeah. That's right. The person who attended her show.
A heckler. Well, not a
right.
heckler. Yeah.
A feedbacker.
And I think that, again, that story she tells about Van Gogh and how she uses it to talk about mental illness and how we view people who struggle with mental illness, who perhaps don't quite fit in, that for me was quite brilliant as well. And that sort of feeds again into how she ends the show. For me, it was that ending was very powerful, another moment when I broke down. And I felt that that idea that you can be defined when you're a man just by your reputation, where else a woman has to, or woman or anyone else has to sort of, anyone else who doesn't fit those neat sort of boxes has to work so hard and do so much and use your trauma and your problems to get even that little amount of space.
And then be dismissed as women's art. I think that's the thing, right? Women tell, when women write stories about our experiences, it's dismissed or it's compartmentalized as women's literature, mm-hmm. you know, which is not the same as
already
great literature.
Is women's stand up.
Exactly.
You know?
And, yeah, and that point she also made about Picasso and the fact that everybody turned and looked the other way because he was cubism. And she and they had decided that the genius of this artist meant that his potential was greater than a 17-year-old's potential ever would. That judgment call had been made on Marie Therese Walter when she was 17. That, look, you are best served as, you know, you're a mistress to a great man. That's your full potential. Congratulations.
At 17.
Mm-hmm. At 17. And that you never thought that when she was 41, which was Picasso's age at the time, that she might also have her own art, her own voice, her own just anything to offer. And that's something that we talk about a lot, I think, in the Me Too context, right? The shutting down of women's earning power, voice, the kind of art and creations that could have been out in the world had these women not been bullied out of the room. And mm-hmm. that was the point she was making. I just thought that was very powerful.
And I think the other thing was, I mean, she also targeted, you know, these men who use their art as an excuse for their bad behavior or, you know, why they're allowed to get away with it. But I think also her real target was the culture that enables them to do that, which is all of us.
Oh, I think, as always, when we talk about the patriarchy, it is really, and yes, that's the big word that needs to come up in every show. When we talk about the patriarchy, it's not just women or non-white men, non-straight white men who suffer. I think it's a system that actually creates issues and problems and victimizes everyone, perhaps
everybody,
in different ways, in to different degree. But no one wins. It's a system where no one is actually winning. And yet we continue to perpetuate this idea that as long as we hold up one particular category of people and give them free passes that the rest of us don't get, that somehow we're going to make it as a race,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
a human race, I mean.
And you know how when she ends, she talks about how, well, she mentioned how she wished she had heard her own story, you know, how that would have helped her so much growing up, you know, in an extremely, what did you call it, Bible Belt of Tasmania, was
yeah.
it? Yeah,
yeah,
where, you know, homosexuality was, I guess, illegal until 1997, you know, where she just was brought up in shame. She grew up in shame. Like even when she was physically abused by that man, she didn't feel enough self-worth to go and report that. And
right.
I think that is something that many women who have faced, many people who have faced abuse, especially women, you know, whether it's domestic violence or whatever, you know, violence in the office, for example, they don't feel that they are worth enough to make that report. And I don't know, hopefully for me, you know, people who see this will actually think of changing that view of themselves.
That's such an interesting point, because when I was watching it, I mean, the main thing I was thinking about was, it's my chief concern when it comes to works that are feminist or are very feminist sometimes in their roots, whether or not this is going to end up preaching to the choir because people don't like discomfort.
Mm.
And the problem with Netflix, right, or not Netflix as a company, but the problem with things like Netflix and YouTube and anything else that you can watch from the comfort and distance of a screen is that you're not going to walk out, are you? If you were in the room, you're not going to walk out. But if you're at home, you just stop it.
Yeah.
And my concern is, and I do want to say this, that as somebody who likes comedy, you should watch this. As someone who likes pop culture and comedy, and just even if I were not a woman who felt, you know, invigorated and enraged by Nanette, I would still say it's such a worthy piece of art to watch. If nothing else, participate in the cultural conversation, people. But, you know, but if But I understand why somebody, even listening to this show, listening to us use words like patriarchy.
I'm sorry.
It was powerful.
Don't apologize.
Yeah, never apologize. But someone listening to this show, listening to us talk about trauma, and you know, nobody's going to get the idea that this is fun and that they really want to watch it. And I wouldn't say it's fun, but I would say you should watch it. So that little recommendation aside, I think it's very easy for people who are accustomed to moving away from discomfort to want to move away from Nanette. And I hope that people don't. I really hope that people sit with it and listen to a woman tell you her story. Don't take it as an attack. I mean, it kind of gets that way in parts.
Yeah.
But what it really is just somebody telling you what has happened to her and trusting you with that story. She tells you that at the end. She says, take care of my story. I'm too tired to take care of it by myself anymore. So take care of it for me. And I think it's our responsibility as people, right, looking at another person in pain, to want to do that. And that's something that a lot of people who, again, are not used to discomfort are not used to doing.
Mm.
It's good practice.
I wonder what it is about people laud movies like Shawshank Redemption or Schindler's List, you know, which in their own way are about discomforts, are about things that are difficult to deal with. And yet somehow they are done in an acceptable, perhaps not maybe making you complicit in those issues that are happening on screen. And perhaps when Nanette does, and because, you know, what I said earlier about the sense of my own sense of, yes, I never thought about Picasso this way when I'm appreciating his art in a museum. It does make you feel, you know, even if a little bit, complicit in the kinds of things that she's talking about. And the truth is, we probably are all complicit in some way. And that is the discomfort that I think is so difficult for people to address and to face up to. And, you know, I don't want to be entertained by this. I don't find this to be entertainment on a Saturday night, to make me feel like I'm a part of all the problems that are happening in the world.
And that you must also solve it.
Right. And I agree with Lynn that I do get that sense that sometimes that sense of preaching to the choir, as great as works like these are, do they change things or do they just stay within that circle of people who might talk about it and not really extend beyond? But then a part of me feels, you know, because I've recommended the show to people who wouldn't read a book on feminism or wouldn't, you know, go to a talk about it, but watched it and then said, wow, you know, that reminded me of something that I went through when I was a kid or something in my marriage or something in my relationship. And I thought, well, yeah, they don't have to come away talking about the patriarchy. But if they come away giving themselves permission to talk about their problems, giving themselves permission, then maybe that's one small step in the right direction.
Yeah, for me, it was, you know, the power of storytelling and how that, you know, can help you actually re-examine your own story and also, like, you know, whether you were complicit in those things that she spoke about. Like, you know, when she spoke about Monica Lewinsky and how she became the butt of every comedian's jokes and nobody ever said anything about Bill Clinton. I realized because, I mean, to be fair, I was much younger when it happened. I was that person as well. You know, I was like, oh, Clinton, oh, yeah, he's a man, you know, he does that. Oh, but Monica Lewinsky, you terrible, you know.
And that's the point that Hannah Gatsby makes as well, right? That point about if you grow up soaking a child in shame, you know, then what do you get? And while we may not have experienced the same things she experienced, I would argue that maybe sometimes by being born women, and Asian women in particular, with a very set idea of what a good Asian woman should be, you know, especially in relationships, especially with the men in your family and in your life, even the best families, we kind of have a lot of baggage to deal with. We have a lot of historical and cultural baggage to deal with. And I can relate to that idea of growing up, even again, in a good household, in a good family, doing their best and being taught in many ways to not like yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yep. I can think of so many examples from my childhood that I still think about sometimes when I do the thing that I'm not supposed to do, because I was told that good women don't do this, you know. Good women are not unruly. Good women have everything under control. Your hair is under control. Your grooming. Don't get me started on grooming. But, you know, grooming, your body, your behavior, everything is demure. And I think that's the thing that is kind of that I'm thinking about from Nanette as well, the permission to be unruly, you know, the permission to think about these things in that light, to look at the things from your childhood and go, well, maybe I don't need to carry this with me.
No, I completely agree. I think as you were talking, I was thinking about this idea of not just being unruly, but don't air your dirty laundry in public.
Yep.
You know, if you're sad, you shouldn't do it in front of everyone. You're not allowed to get angry. And these are not things, you know, and I feel like when you confront some of these issues with the people in your family, you realize that these are issues they struggle with too. And it's almost like this has been passed on through the generations without anyone quite talking about why we've let this sort of fossilize into the way we raise our families and our children and our women and men, I think. And that is one of the things that Nanette does. It cracks through that fossil and sort of says, no, everyone needs to be given the permission to feel something, to feel not just happy and satisfied and joyous all the time, but to also feel the other things, the dark sides of what it can feel like to be who you are.
And that's what you can relate to from a queer woman from Tasmania, you know, because I think, again, it's so easy to pack Nanette off into a little box and say, this is the work of a feminist, this is the work of a woman, a queer woman, and then it turns into like, oh, gay comedy or something. You know, it becomes very kind of shuttered off.
Yes.
But when I watched it, I really thought about my upbringing as an Asian woman and all the things that nobody meant to inflict on me, but here we are, you know? And I hope that people won't dismiss it out of hand because they look at Hannah Gadsby and don't see themselves, you know, because I think there's something in there for everyone, genuinely. I know that's a very trite thing to say, but I really believe that.
Okay. All right. So I guess the bottom line is everyone should at least watch it, give it a shot.
Give it a shot.
Talk about it.
Be open-minded. And watch it, yeah.
So Nanette is actually available on Netflix, and do go and watch it or read up about Hannah Gadsby. And thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking to Sharmila Gunnison and Lee Chui Lin, both producers and presenters with BFM 89.9, and we were discussing Hannah Gadsby's Nanette. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Feminist Fridays interviews, you can search for the podcasts on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the App Store. This has been Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.